Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everyone to the Wellness Ultimatum Radio. I'm your host, Omar Cumberbatch. Today we have an awesome show. We have Tiffany Schneider, who will be welcoming to the show. Tiffany is the author of Learn Happiness and Love. It is a series of lessons that she uncovered working as an individual and couples counselor in the Bay Area. She wrote the book to help learn the tools it takes to be happy and have better relationships. Tiffany lives in Palo Alto, California, and works with clients everywhere who want to be happier and improve their relationships. She works with individuals, couples, and families. She has an MA in counseling psychology from the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology, now Sophia University, and an MA in organizational development and leadership from the University of San Francisco. She's also a certified process therapist, a certified hypnotherapist, and a certified fitness nutrition coach. Tiffany, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you for having me, Omar.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. I just wanted to give you a little bit of an opportunity to just tell the audience about your journey and how did you start in this field and a little bit about yourself.
Okay, great. Well, I originally was working in development in anthropology. I worked with hill tribes throughout Burma and Thailand. I worked in Egypt, and I had worked a little bit around the world, and I decided I wanted to go back to school to get a PhD in anthropology. And on my way, thinking about what interested me, which was working with individuals, I ended up deciding to go for counseling instead and just do another master's. And I myself had been going through some relationship issues in my own marriage and had started going for counseling and found that the counseling was so beneficial to me that I both loved the counselor and loved the school where I was going to see the clinician and decided to pursue my master's at that time.
Awesome, awesome. Now, you have a very, very broad background, which is very interesting. And like, how did you touch on all these different areas and how you basically became to have a little of your own philosophy on how to deal with these relationship issues?
Yeah, so I really feel like all the experiences that I've had have really come together at this point in my life to help me be able to help others, particularly in a world where I feel and see that more and more clients are coming from diverse backgrounds, particularly in the United States, where we've got people who, you know, many are from either different socioeconomic backgrounds, different religions, different ethnicities. And so having had this experience of both living abroad, working abroad, and then working in so many different cultures, as well as having studied psychology from, you know, the transpersonal perspective, which is more of a spiritual perspective, has really given me the ability to think creatively and also see problems from a more humane perspective. I find that sometimes in the counseling world, we can get really clinical and medical in the way we approach, you know, what they would call in the counseling world mental illness, but in the coaching world, what would be called, you know, just everyday problems sometimes. It really just kind of gives me varied experience and varied life experience in order to help people with different kinds of problems, with different life experiences.
Very awesome, awesome. Now, tell us a little bit about the book that you just, you know, wrote, and I should say actually just wrote because you have a new book, and we'll talk about that one later, but the book, How to Be Happy and Learn Love.
So Learn Happiness and Love came about. I was working, I was doing an internship in the city of San Leandro. I was working with high school students, and I was working in a counseling, family counseling practice. And I was having to have, you know, some problems on my own within my own relationship. And I was starting to notice certain themes that always came up in the counseling room with people who sometimes were having, you know, maybe larger problems than everyday problems. And at the same time, I was experiencing my own relationship problems. And I thought to myself one day, you know, I noticed that I'm teaching people, and I use the word teaching on purpose because we do a lot of teaching in counseling. Teaching people a lot of the same skills over and over, regardless of what their problem is or what their background is or even their age, whether it was high school students or adults. And it would be really nice to kind of consolidate this information and create a self-help tool for people. And at the same time, I felt like I myself wanted to understand better what it really took to make it work in relationship because of my own personal issues that I was having. And so I decided to start writing. And it was a personal journey that I felt that, you know, once I would complete, not only would I feel like I really knew everything I was teaching other people, but that I would pick up some more along the way to practice in my own life and then be able to share with other people in an easier format than, let's say, you know, counseling, because not other, every person has means both time-wise or financially to either go to a counselor or a coach. And a lot of people enjoy the privacy of being able to self-teach them things, you know, themselves at home through the internet. And along my journey, I had seen so many people online in forums, on blogs, that seemed to be really unhappy, and it kind of broke my heart. And I felt like, wow, there's so much out there to help people, and everyone should have access. And that's kind of how my journey started. So I started writing.
You know, it's really cool. I really enjoyed like how you actually set the book up. I don't want to give too much away. I want you to explain it to the audience a little bit, but how did you come to break down each chapter like you did, which was really interesting to me as far as when I was reading it?
So I actually, when I was much younger, I did some teaching, and I taught English as a second language, and I, you know, had certifications as a teacher. And ever since, some of the models that I had used in teaching in terms of conveying information to people that I felt really made material easy to grasp stuck with me. And so when I wrote this book, I really wasn't thinking of writing a book that's kind of like any other nonfiction or fiction novel. I wanted to write a series of lessons that a person could, you know, not only relate to easily, but also, you know, understand the theory and then practically apply what they had just learned so they could really ingrain what they had learned. And likewise, in my way of practicing coaching at this point, and when I was a counselor, how I was practicing counseling, and as a process therapist, I was really hands-on in terms of, it was really important to me that when people had a new understanding about themselves or learned something new, that they would have a practical application of it, that they would have the experience of applying this new information so that they would pick it up quicker and know how to use what they had just learned in life. And so that's why I formatted the book as I did, with questions and then theory and then, you know, practical exercises at the end of every quote-unquote lesson.
Yeah, no, I really liked that. You really did put it away so that, you know, people can actually start learning about how to put these actual practices into place. What was some of your favorite topics that you felt when you were writing this book and how, like, they would be most helpful in the majority of people's lives?
That's a really good question. I think that in writing the book, that it was a very individual process for me. When I was writing from a perspective of, you know, what did I feel like really changed me in life? What knowledge did I pick up, both studying psychology and working as a counselor? Because working as a counselor and as a coach, one thing that I don't know everybody knows, but you actually learn just as much as your clients from your clients. It's a very mind-opening process. And so what were the lessons that I had picked up that I felt had transformed my own life that I wanted to share? And what were kind of the ones that most people seem to get a lot out of, or quote-unquote a lot of bang for their buck in counseling or coaching? I think one of the number one issues for a lot of people is boundary setting. Many people who are suffering in their lives have difficulties with boundaries, usually with others, but sometimes even with themselves. How do you say yes to what you want and really give yourself permission to take what you need for yourself without feeling like you're selfish? And at the same time, how do you say no to other people and not always worry about, you know, other people's feelings, how it affects other people, but think about, okay, well, what's healthy for me? So I think that boundary setting is a big one. Another one that I think is a big one is expectations and relationships. A lot of people, you know, feel like their unhappiness is being caused by the fact that the other person in their relationships is not giving them what they need to be happy. And, you can really set yourself up in that paradigm, because what happens is nobody will ever be able to make you happy. Only you can make you happy. And it's a big one for romantic relationships, but it's the same whether it's family members, your children. You know, everything starts from you and you kind of freeing your own self up from these expectations of others and of yourself sometimes too. So I think those are the, you know, two that stand out for me right now. Did you have anything else in mind?
Oh, yeah, I have a couple. I'm definitely going to get my selfish part of the show on in a second and some of the topics that I found really, really interesting. But I definitely want to go back to the boundary setting, because I did have a question about that particular thing. And I found this particularly interesting because you were talking about, like, giving and, you know, compassion and stuff like that in the book. And in regards to the boundary setting, I wrote down, it's like one chapter you mentioned that if you are giving something and you really hate doing it, then maybe it's not the right thing to give. So I found that interesting because everyone keeps saying, oh, you should be more, like I said, compassionate, give things, be more like charitable, and people end up maybe doing things that they don't really want to do. And I really like the way that you just kind of said, if it doesn't necessarily feel right, you just don't give because it's expected of you. So it kind of circles both things that you just said. What does it have to do in that sense with the boundary setting?
That's a really, really good question. And I think that that's a really, I think that's a really important question, and I think it's something that I constantly play with myself. But where I've come to terms with this issue is, if you look at most spiritual traditions, whether it's one's religious background or just, you know, basic humanitarian practice, there's this idea that giving is really an aspiration. And even in a lot of mental health settings, you know, sometimes people will be taken out to do voluntary work or to, you know, get their minds off of things, maybe even in an AA setting or other settings where giving helps you kind of take your mind off of your own stuff. And by giving, you feel better about yourself because you've done something meaningful in the world. So I think that there is definitely a lot to be said for giving as one of the keys to happiness. However, a lot of us are also very unhealthy because we've learned to give at our own expense. We've learned to give even though it hurts us or we really don't want to do it. And so it's really that balance. You know, a healthy person is the one that learns how to balance between giving and giving to themselves, right? So every spiritual tradition tells you, you know, give to the other, but then there's the caveat of as you would give to yourself. And that's what a lot of people forget about, is that giving to yourself, you practice on yourself everything that you do in the world. If you're not kind to yourself, if you're not giving to yourself, you cannot be kind and giving to the others. So it's not really a selfish act at all to not give when you don't feel like giving. You're teaching yourself how to be kind towards yourself, and you're modeling it for others as well. But it's something that a lot of us have difficulties with, particularly because there can be a reaction. You have to build up, you know, your own ego strength enough to be able to say no to giving and be able to face that sometimes there might be a reaction from the person in front of you, and that person might even, you know, say something or try to make you feel like what you're doing is not okay. And if you can get yourself to the point where you feel complete with your actions, that's when you've gotten healthy, right? When you can justify it with yourself, when you feel okay with yourself. Of course, that doesn't mean not listening to others. You know, it doesn't mean that you don't need to change or learn new things, but it's definitely learning how to become complete with yourself.
That's a great, great answer. And I think that even brings us back to the idea that you were just mentioning earlier about the idea of you have to say no to things. And I've read many places that no is a complete sentence. So you don't have to necessarily justify why you say no or why you don't have to do this or do that. If you could expound on that a little bit and just kind of give the audience even more tools to set these boundaries by just saying no to certain things that they might not feel comfortable with.
Yeah, I think that what you said at the end is a big part of it. It doesn't always feel comfortable to say no, but you have to start practicing if you want to get better at it. You know, I've personally watched people because I'm always curious about people who seem to be happy or people who seem to be living the life they want to live. And I've noticed people who have an easier time saying no than others. And I will question them about how did you get to that point where it's easier to say no. So some people, it's nature. You know, some people have an easier time saying no, and some people have a really, really hard time saying no. And there's advantages to every personality type. But all I can say is that you really just sometimes you have to do things even when it's not comfortable because you know it's the right thing to do for your long-term happiness. So maybe right now in the moment, saying no might feel really uncomfortable, but if you let your mind kick in and you think an hour ahead or a day ahead, depending on the circumstance and what we're talking about, once you've said that no, you get the payoff. And so just for people to remind themselves that saying no doesn't necessarily feel good, but that doesn't mean it's not the right thing to do, right?
Right.
Another thing is a lot of this goes back to how, you know, we were individually raised. Some of us were raised in much more disciplinarian households where you couldn't say no to your parents. That wasn't okay. You know, you were conditioned to give. You were conditioned to be the good child. You were conditioned to listen to what you were told. Now, there's some good things to know how to have discipline and do as you're told, and there's some really bad things to it, too. You know, on the extreme end of it, you know, societies or people who didn't know how to say no sometimes got themselves into situations where they were going along with scenarios that were, you know, they shouldn't have been going along with. And so there's a danger to not knowing how to say no. And I think that every human being needs to remind themselves how important it is to have your own conscience. A lot of this goes back to your conscience with yourself and your conscience towards others. And you know, there's this, sometimes they're in contrast, but there's a combination between, again, that concept of loving yourself and also listening to your conscience. And when you combine the two, you can usually find the right answer in terms of where is the right place and when's the right time to say no.
Gotcha, gotcha. I also wanted to just pick your brain and the idea, like, how much role does, you know, the feeling of guilt play in not being able to say no for some people?
Guilt is a big one, and I do talk about it in the book. I think that we all have mechanisms within us, within our psyche, and they're there for a reason. You know, some people might think that guilt is just this terrible thing, and actually guilt plays an important role. It's a mediator. It lets you know when you're hitting the boundary of something that might not be okay. But it doesn't mean that your guilt is always what needs to lead you. And in fact, rather than punishing yourself, because guilt can sometimes be a way of punishing yourself, learn from your experiences. So as opposed to going, you know, focusing on guilt, which a lot of times guilt can be in the past. Guilt can be feeling guilty for something that's been done already. Take that information, take what the guilt is trying to tell you, and use it to make better decisions towards the future. Because usually if you're feeling guilty, there's something inside of you that's saying, I wish I would have done that differently. Well, that's the past, and it's okay that you did it. Forgive yourself that you did it, and now see how you can be differently today with what you've learned. That's, I think, the best solution or the best medicine for guilt.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. I know it plays such a huge role in a lot of people's decisions. So it's like, I'm glad that we brought that up as a topic as well. I also wanted to just touch on, I found that you had like a really, really interesting concept. And you stated that we should see others' flaws as momentary weaknesses and not as a sign of a personality flaw. What did you mean by that? And why is this perspective so effective when you're trying to, like, cultivate relationships?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I think that what happens is sometimes when people in a particular situation, if somebody that you care for, usually it's somebody that's important to you, because if it's somebody that's not important to you, it doesn't affect you so much. But if they're doing something that bothers you, if you automatically you know, characterize it as a personality flaw, you're locking them into that defect or that problem. You're saying this person can't change, they're defective, right?
Mm-hmm.
And really, it could be this person acted this way in this moment. I don't like it. I can do something about it now, but I don't have to condemn our future together because of this one act right now. Now, of course, that can change. If somebody's repeatedly doing something similar that you really just don't want to be around, then you can make the choice to not be around that person anymore. But everybody's got, nobody can be perfect 24 hours a day. I'm sure if you analyze, or any of us analyze, all of our relationships, every single person that we love has things that are not always easy for us to deal with. And if we are going to let go of people from our lives, or, you know, have really adverse reactions to them because of their mistakes, then we're going to alienate ourselves from a lot of people. And in the mm-hmm. long run, you really don't have control over changing other people. I mean, you can definitely speak up if somebody does something you don't like. You can set your boundaries, as we were talking about, and say no, agree, you know, say I don't want to be around you when you're like this, or voice if you see something that's going on. But ultimately, you really only have control over your actions, not who they are going to be in this world. And so it's really healthier to be focused on what you can change about yourself, as opposed to trying to change everybody else around you, the world around you, you know. Yeah, so I think that's what I have to say about that.
Yeah, I guess I know the answer, but I think you'd probably verbalize it way better. Like, and you kind of mentioned it, but like, how many times does something have to happen for it to be a personality flaw, as opposed to like that moment of weakness? Is it something that's individualistic?
Uh huh. Yeah, and I could see how that would be a question probably for a lot of people. I don't think that there's a particular number, even though I could see definitely the usefulness of kind of pulling a number out, you know, to help people. I think that's really individual. I think it's about, when do you get to a point where you're not happy anymore being around this person? And that changes. If this is your mother, that's different than if this is somebody you go for coffee with, right? It's a lot easier mm-hmm. to stop going for coffee with this random person than it is to stop seeing your mother. I mean, there's much different ramifications around that. You know, you could just pull a number out of the hat and say three strikes are out. But I don't really think it's about that. I think that sometimes you stick something out with somebody who's repeatedly doing something that drives you crazy, and somehow you soften up because you just went with it for a while and you got over it. And other times, you're really being unkind to yourself that you continually subjugate yourself to that person, right? And so I think mm-hmm. it's really about a person sitting with themselves and going, okay, what am I doing? Why am I continuing to allow myself to be around this if this is not good for me? Is it something that I, you know, can continue to live with because I'm learning something from it? Or do I need to now, you know, think about my own needs and say, either speak up, leave the situation, or, you know, do whatever other option they might have in that situation. But I definitely don't advocate for a person sitting in a situation that makes them miserable forever. You know, at one point, mm-hmm. it's good to react. One thing that we would say is that if you're still sitting in it, chances are it's not uncomfortable enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of one of those expressions that they would use in the counseling world. But what I mean by that is, if somebody's putting up with a situation, sometimes it means it hasn't gone bad enough for them to leave. Now, that's the question. Are they going to wait for it to get bad enough? Or are they going to actually do something about it? And that, again, I don't think that there's one right answer. I really believe that there are different answers depending on the situation, and that the individual kind of has to personally create their answers. That's what makes them a unique individual living their own unique experience.
You know, so again, goes back to that, you know, kind of the boundary settings and like the expectation of the individual. So I think you nailed those two. Those are really two important themes that I think that you touched on in the book, and as well as on this interview.
Right.
But I'm glad I have a little segue into the idea of happiness. And then you mentioned in your book that happiness is a fluid internal state. And I thought that was cool how you phrased it. Why is that concept so important, and how did you come up with that idea?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
I said in your book, you said you mentioned that happiness is a fluid internal state. So
right.
I was just asking, you know, why is that concept so important? How did you come up with that particular idea?
I think that concept is so important because we are, at least as somebody living in America, I feel like I have been fed a lot of different ideas of what happiness should be, whether it's the movies or whether it's what, you know, friends might say or whether it's the internet. There's this idea that happiness is kind of a more exciting state than what it really what I've discovered it to be working in counseling and mental health and coaching and spirituality. I think that happiness is really about getting to a place of balance and peace with yourself. And it really isn't really extreme states. Although sometimes those can be fun too, and I think that for that changes, you know, just like some people love to run marathons and other people like to do yoga, you know, individually, happiness might look a little different for each person, but it's really getting to that place where you are gentle with yourself and where you feel peaceful within yourself, and you don't have these extreme highs and lows, that you're not going up and down on the scale emotionally, right? And that's what happiness is. Happiness is when you're able to maintain a certain equanimity over a period of time. And I think that's important because if somebody's aspiring for happiness to be this constant euphoria, then they can get themselves into a lot of kind of dangerous scenarios. I mean, it's why, you know, we have people that get prone to addictions or that get prone to extreme states, because some people are looking for that high constantly, and it's just not maintainable for long periods of time to always be on a high. And so kind of having a more realistic expectation of what happiness looks like, I think is beneficial so that a person, you know, isn't aspiring for something that they can't reach.
No, I totally agree. And I think that idea is what the problem is. People's expectation of happiness, like you said, it's supposed to be something that happens all the time. It's supposed to be such high. It's supposed to be so ecstatic. It's unattainable. And I'm glad that, you definitely defined it at least I agree with that concept as well. Can you give us some tips on what you think can assist us in making us more, quote-unquote, happy?
Sure. Well, I think, the first thing, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, is, it's almost going to contradict what you're asking, but why is it so important to us to be happy? I mean, I think that there are other values that we're calling it happiness, but happiness is kind of a term that tricks our mind sometimes. I think that the aspiration is to be balanced in your relationships, to be balanced in the way you eat, to be balanced with your body, to be balanced with your passions, to be balanced with your spirituality. Don't leave out any parts of yourself in your life. A lot of us, will sometimes let go of certain sides of ourselves in when we're in pursuit of something particular. So, like, if you're trying to be successful, you stop working out or you stop spending time with good friends. Don't do that. Don't, let go of parts of yourself in the name of only one side. Really encompass and nurture every part of your being in order to be to have that more equanimous status. I think another thing for happiness that's really important is it's really important to have some kind of connection with your spiritual world, whether or not you're religious, whether or not you believe in God or not, whether or not you believe in nature. It's really important to have a connection to something that's beyond just the everyday material world. And you as a listener know what that is for you. Whether for you that just means going and taking a walk in nature or going to church on Sunday, don't give that up, because that's really that time in your week that allows you to connect with something greater than, you know, the everyday material or the everyday problems. So definitely having that. I'm also a firm believer in, you know, mind, body, spirit. It's really important to keep yourself healthy on the physical level in order to be happy. If you are sitting in front of a computer all day long and you're not getting any exercise, you're not going to be happy. It's really important to have a routine for yourself that incorporates keeping your body healthy, eating healthy, exercising. And for every person, that looks different. You know, as I was saying earlier, some people like to jog and some people, you know, like to do yoga. Find that exercise that is maintainable for you in a long term, not something that you're going to, you know, get really motivated and do for 3 days and then you just can't sustain it because it's either too much effort for you or you don't really enjoy it. Find that one thing and make it really an integral part of your life. I think another thing is vacations. Really important to just schedule it in and not make excuses about not having enough time, you know, not having enough money. A vacation can even be a staycation. It could be taking a couple of days off from your home and just spending some good time with great friends out in the park, you know, having something to drink that you love to drink. But really, again, taking that time out for yourself to enjoy really are all fundamental to happiness. And really having loving relationships, having people in your life that you can turn to when you need to be nurtured, and at the same time being a very nurturing person to the people that you love. You will experience yourself in very humble ways if you are able to express your loving side to different people in your, you know, in your environment. And you will also feel like you're loved and nurtured if you have that one or two or hopefully even more people that you can go to when, you know, when you feel like having that intimate conversation, when you're feeling down, when you need to bounce ideas off those people. So all of those things need to be perpetually maintained in order for a person to keep up that state of ongoing, you know, peace within and happiness that we're talking about.
No, that was really great. I really, really liked that idea of balance and don't let go of yourself. Because I personally find myself doing the exact thing that you're advising against. And like you said, you have a goal, then you start just chasing that goal, and then all of a sudden the blinders are on, and you don't necessarily get to a peak relationship, you know, take care of yourself in different ways, maybe take time for yourself. So I really, really like that idea, and I'm going to start using that a lot. That is my definition now. So thank you for that explanation. That was really good.
Sure. And let me just bring up one other point. You know, I was thinking back about what we were saying about the giving. This idea of giving within your everyday life really brings a lot of happiness, but it doesn't need to be, like we were saying, in the format of doing something that feels like an enormous self-sacrifice. You can give by doing small acts of kindness. You know, there's that coin phrase in your everyday life, whether it's, you know, helping your neighbor across the street that's elderly, or, you know, carrying groceries for someone, going to visit your grandfather. You know, little acts like that can bring a lot of meaning to your life, and they don't have to be grandiose, but they kind of add another element where you feel like you're doing things that are meaningful in this world. And that's immeasurable in terms of the kind of, you know, small joys that can bring to the individual, of feeling like they've done something significant in the world or for someone else.
Great point. I do want to touch on, you know, one topic for sure, because obviously it's a part of your book as well. Just if you can talk a little bit about, you know, learning love. And I know that you mentioned it in certain capacities, but I wanted to at least focus in on that particular part of your book, which you have, you know, great, great tips throughout the book. But if you can expand on just the idea of learning, you know, how to love, how to be loved, and that concept.
Yeah. So I really found through my work that love is a practice that one can learn just like anything else, and that there are certain tools or certain, you know, things that everyone should know. And one of them is that I think that at least this is the message that I was given growing up in America. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that everybody received that message. But for me, there was this concept or this idea that a relationship is good if you feel like you're getting a lot from it, if that person is giving you a lot. And the older I get and the more that I've worked in clinical practice or in coaching practices with couples, with families, with children, the one thing that always stood out was, actually, if you want to have a healthy and great relationship, give as much as you can to that relationship, as opposed to having, again, back to those expectations of that other person. And it will come back to you, but don't focus on what they're doing for you. Focus on what you're doing in the relationship. You know, and by the more you give, the more effort you make, the more beautiful that relationship will become for you. And this kind of, you know, goes from the smallest to the biggest aspect of what it means to relation, to be in relationship. So sometimes that might mean, giving might mean letting go. You know, back to what you were talking about earlier, you know, maybe your partner, your child, your sibling is being really moody today. Why don't you try letting it go today? Why don't you try not getting all steamy and caught up with them and just let it go? Give them that mm-hmm. as a gift and see how that benefits the relationship and benefits you. The second thing, you know, coming off of that is ego. Ego plays a really strong role in inhibiting us from having, you know, the biggest love potential we can have. And this comes up in a lot of spiritual practices, but you also see it a lot in working in coaching or counseling, is that, you know, there's a healthy pride, which says, okay, I'm going to take care of myself. But then there's the ego that comes in that can really be inhibiting of having a good relationship, because sometimes it becomes about the ego instead of getting to a place of entente or getting to a place where there's a kind relationship happening between two individuals. So really trying to figure out what your priorities are. If you, if your goal is to have a loving relationship, then that's going to look different sometimes than being right. In fact, sometimes you might even have to look not very smart or not look very, you know, or let go of being right in the name of having a loving relationship. And this takes really knowing how to let go of that ego. But it comes from a strong place, because if you know within yourself that you are lovable and worthy and wonderful, you don't necessarily need somebody else to tell you that, because you're giving it to yourself. Mm-hmm. So within the concept of a loving relationship, you know, sometimes somebody in front of you might be saying, well, you're wrong and you're bad and that's not okay and what you're doing is wrong. And if you know within yourself that you're not wrong and you're not bad, then you're not going to become fixated on what they're saying. What's going to be important to you is, you know, where do we come to solution? What's the real issue here? What are we really trying to figure out? So that's the second, you know, big tool, is really trying to take ego off the table and make having a loving relationship more important. I think the third tool, it comes back to this concept of self-love. If you are able to love yourself and make your own life worthwhile living, you're going to be fun to be around, and you're naturally going to attract relationships to you. A lot of times, if you're unhappy with yourself, you become unhappy in your relationships, because you start, you know, either blaming your relationships or having, again, these expectations of the relationships to give you that happiness. So really trying to practice a lot of self-love so you take that burden off of the relationships, and then you can really see your relationships for what they are, as opposed to what you're wanting them to fulfill for you. How is that? Did you want some more tips, or is that a good start?
Oh, it's a great start. I'm writing all this stuff down. I'm obviously not good at shorthand. You can't see it, but I'm trying to keep up. But thank God I can always replay this. So these are excellent tips. I really like the fact that you did bring up the ego, and I know a lot of people really struggle with that idea that they have to be right and they have to actually be in control. Like, where does forgiveness come into play with this kind of stuff? Even like if the person doesn't feel that they did something wrong or something like that, how do you kind of get to a place where you can just let bygones be bygones, in other words?
Yeah, that's a big one with ego, is the forgiveness. And you know, forgiveness, a lot of times we think that forgiveness is I'm forgiving you and I'm doing you a favor, but really a lot of times we forgive for our own sake so we don't have to hold on to that. And so, you know, it really stems back again to that idea of if you're setting your own value with yourself and you're not hoping for other people to give you your value, then it doesn't really matter. It doesn't always really matter what the other people do. One big thing that you learn when you work with people in coaching and counseling is that a lot of times when people do something to you, it's not about you. So if you're with somebody and they're hurting you, a lot of times, even though it might not feel that way, they might not be hurting you because of something that you've done, but because of issues that they have with themselves. And if you can really grasp that, it really lightens up the load for you in a relationship because you don't make the same meaning out of situation. So if you're standing before, let's say, your partner, and your partner is like, God, you're so selfish, and you always do that to me, and I'm so sick of you, you know. Obviously, we're hoping the couples aren't talking to each other this way, but of course this happens. That person could be saying that for a million reasons. That partner could be hungry and tired or could be hating themselves because they're doing bad at work. But you standing before them feel like, oh, my God, I'm all these things that they said, and really it might not even be about that. So the forgiveness is even bigger than just saying, hey, I forgive you for saying that to me. It's, you know what, I forgive kind of the human nature of us getting into these situations where we get so angry and we say things that we regret, and kind of having a sense of completeness with the nature of this life that we're all living, which is, you know, we're born, we don't know why we're here necessarily, and one day we're going to die, and the people around us die. And that's a really big subject that all of us are walking around trying to grasp, and it comes out in all kinds of strange ways, right? But yeah, it's definitely this concept of forgiveness is one that is imperative to have good relationships. If you can't forgive the people around you, you can't have relationships, because the people around you will always slip. Nobody's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you've given me a great amount of information. I want to just thank you to say how much I appreciate it as well. I just want to kind of wind it down a little bit, and I just want to see, and I always like to ask my guests, like, as far as, like, your wellness regime, because this is definitely about, you know, being wellness and in a holistic way. Like, what do you eat? What is your, like, exercise program? Like, how do you keep your body in shape?
Yeah, I definitely into wellness to keep my own happiness and balance. When I wake up in the morning, I try to get a good night's sleep always. I try to go to bed not too late at night. When I wake up in the morning, I like to eat a healthy, light breakfast, whole grains, fruit, nuts. I try not to overeat. Is, you know, a big thing that I work with is trying to eat portions that satisfy me but that aren't more than my body needs. I do exercise about 6 times a week, but not necessarily extraneous activity. Every day I try and do something different because I like to vary it so that I keep it interesting for myself. And so it's a pleasure for me. I will go to the gym. I walk. I do dance. I swim. Every day I do something different. But I always get something in, and I try and get something in that I feel like doing. If I really don't feel like doing something, I don't force myself to do something that I really don't want to do. So I try and find something that day it works for the way I'm feeling. So that one day it might be I'm going to turn on YouTube and put on a YouTube video for stretching, and the next day it might be going to the gym, and the third day it might be taking a Zumba class, whatever I'm kind of in the mood for, but I make it a priority that I get in an hour a day of exercise. Sometimes more, sometimes a little bit less. And I have a spiritual practice. It's not, you know, within the context of my own religion or spirituality. I try and make sure that every week I have a time that I kind of disconnect and make time with family and, you know, reading books that interest me or going to the community center or, you know, doing holidays, things of that nature. So I think that those are kind of some of the ways I keep myself balanced. I try to, on the one hand, really enjoy technology, but also know how to sometimes disconnect and not, you know, overburden myself with technology. And I think those are some of the ways I start in keeping myself balanced day to day.
No, you sound like you are very, very balanced. So that is a great thing. That is a great thing. I just want to give you the opportunity to have the floor to say whatever parting tips or ideas that you wanted to share with the audience, and also definitely how to get your book, how to get this as well.
Yeah, so... In terms of parting tips, I think that it is it's really important to keep growing in life. You know, in this effort to be at peace, we also can't be stagnant. Part of the beauty of life is continually letting yourself learn new things about yourself and growing from them without being angry at yourself, without kind of feeling sad about the past, but constantly questioning when something bothers you or when you're in moments of stress or, you know, something's not going right for you, asking yourself why and trying to learn from that so that you can maybe do something a little different or learn something different about it so that in the present or tomorrow you make yourself even happier. I think that's kind of the biggest tip that I can give because that's applicable to everything from how you eat to what you do with your body to how you conduct yourself in relationships is as long as you keep yourself curious instead of allowing yourself to kind of wallow when things get hard, then there's a silver lining and you will move towards that silver lining as opposed to kind of getting static. In terms of my book, the book that we've been discussing, Learn Happiness and Love, really if you just go on the internet and type Learn Happiness and Love, Tiffany Schneider, my name, it will pop up right away on Google. It can be found through Dorrance Publishing. And then the second book that I was telling you that I wrote that is more specific to couples and couples issues and learning how to do couplehood so that you can have a wonderful and loving relationship is called Hold My Hand, Secrets to Lasting Love. And that can be found on Amazon.com. And both books are available in both print and electronic format.
Great, great. Well, I really, really just want to thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate it. I think you were an awesome guest, and I definitely took a lot of notes, and I'm sure the audience will be taking a lot of notes too. And I definitely want to recommend the book. I thought it was great. Definitely helped me out in a couple of enlightening ways, so I thank you for that.
Thank you so much for having me, and I appreciated all your insightful questions, and I hope that your listeners got as much out of listening to this as I got out of speaking with you.
I'm sure that they did. You were wonderful.
Great. Right, thank you, Omar, so much.
Thank you so much. All right, have a good night.
You as well. Bye-bye.
All right. That was Tiffany Schneider. Wow, she was really, really great. She gave such important tips and facts about just relationships and happiness. I mean, really changed my perspective on a couple of things. It's definitely worth getting. The name of the book, again, is Learn Happiness and Love. Her name is Tiffany Schneider. Her last name is S-C-H-N-E-I-D-E-R. Great book. Please pick it up. You won't be disappointed. Next week's guest is Kim Aides. Kim is one of the North America's foremost experts on performance through thought mastery. She works exclusively with highly driven, accomplished executives, entrepreneurs, and professionals in their fields and uses the unique frame of mind coaching process to ignite significant change in life transformations. Looking forward to her as a guest. And I just want to thank everybody again for listening. My name is Omar Cumberbatch, and this is the Wellness Ultimatum Radio. Have a good night.